Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the Movie Review Podcast, where we are a movie review podcast. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Wrap, and gosh darn it, everybody calls me Bibbs.
Hello, William.
Hi.
Nice to have you here. My name is Whitney Seibold, and I, too, am a film critic. I contribute to Slash Film, a senior staff writer over there, and that's my job.
Sure is.
That's what I do these days.
Yeah. The best there is at what you do, and what you do is review Beverly Hills Cop 4. This week on Critically Acclaimed, we are reviewing Beverly Hills Cop 4, a.k.a. Beverly Hills Cop Axel F., or as Drew McQueenie cleverly pointed out, Beverly Hills Cop AF.
Oh, there you go.
It's almost clever.
Now, the Beverly Hills Cop was never the Eddie Murphy character, however. Axel Foley's from Detroit.
Yeah, and he's never
a Detroit cop.
He's never worked as a Beverly Hills cop. In fact, every time he's been in Beverly Hills, it has been in an unofficial capacity.
Yeah.
So, the Beverly Hills Cop was actually Judge Reinhold this whole time.
I know Judge Reinhold was in the first.
He was in all four.
He comes back for the fourth.
He was in all four.
I haven't seen two or three, so this is going to be interesting.
We'll talk about all of them in a minute. We're also going to be reviewing the conclusion of Ty West's Mia Goth trilogy, Maxine, which follows the films X and Pearl. And we're going to be reviewing the animated film. It is a film, and it is animated. It is called
The Animated Film.
Yeah. It's Despicable Me 4, a.k.a. Corporations. God, they love their minions.
Those minions know how to rake in cash.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
The kids love the minions, so they're just going to milk those minions for as much minion milk as they can.
Yeah, you know what joke has aged really well already was in the movie, and no one saw it but you and me, Mortal Engines.
Yes.
Which is, you know, story-wise, very formulaic. The visual effects,
astonishing.
Amazingly
really
inventive. Images I've never seen before in a film. Like, just absolutely fantastic.
Two entire cities on outsized tank treads are able to crawl across the countryside and kind of do battle with one eating and disassembling the other.
A city eats another city, and it's awesome, and people just shrugged.
Yeah.
Anyway, but there's a joke in that one because it takes place in the distant future where there are, like, anthropologists or archaeologists about the ancient world, and they have these, like, statues of minions, and they assume that they were our gods, and honestly, yeah.
They kind of are.
They're our idols. Yeah, that's what we have instead of...
And they do illuminate in the darkness from... They scream out the word illumination.
I suppose that is
And that is
true,
that is their mantra.
That's only mildly forced.
Thank you. This is the sick... I guess we'll start with that one.
Because
it is the biggest hit of the weekend. It's made, like, over $120 million on its opening weekend domestically. These little minions just keep on raking in the cash, which is weird because I've always felt the Despicable Me movies have kind of a weak premise. The idea is the main character, Gru, is voiced by Steve Carell, using a kind of a moose and squirrel Russian-ish accent, is an aspiring supervillain.
Yeah.
But a supervillain in a way that doesn't seem to fit into any known mythology. Like, kind of a supervillain from a James Bond movie, but a little bit more cartoony than that.
I feel like because Gru, this bothered me when I first saw Despicable Me, that Gru was in a world where there are a bunch of supervillains, but there are no superheroes, which struck me as imbalanced. But what I neglected to consider was that in Europe, and these have a very European-minded sort of mentality, especially to the early films.
French movies.
Yeah. But my point is that they're not, like, trying to be as Western as possible. There's definitely a European tone and aesthetic tone. There actually is a tradition of just supervillains having their own shtick. Diabolik is a supervillain, and he's the star. There is no superhero counterpart proper that we would consider meaningful. It's just about following the adventures of this supervillain. There's Dr. Mabuse. Mabuza. Yeah. Apologies. There are traditions of this. We don't really have a lot of analogs in America.
That's true.
You know? So
maybe the closest we might come is, like, Jason Voorhees. Like,
our horror villains.
We go to those movies because we want to see the monster. We don't want to see the heroes defeat the monster. Like, the heroes kind of have to.
Yeah.
Just to make it satisfying, but
we're
there to see the monsters do damage.
But the villains in those horror movies, which are basically supervillains, you know, Freddy Krueger has dream powers.
Yeah.
They're not, like, fun. I mean, sometimes Freddy Krueger was, but, like, they're intended to be terrified. They murder. Mm. Whereas Gru wants to do things like steal the moon.
Yeah.
Which is... It's like you almost have to respect it. Like, that takes effort, what you do.
It is the freeze rays and shrink rays and all the rest. There was... It's a little odd that these films have become as popular as they have because of that.
Mm.
And there was something I always felt... Well, not always, but, you know, if you dig deep, you can find something that feels a little bit subversive in the Despicable Me movies.
Mm.
Because not only are they about villains, but the kids really love the Minions.
Yeah.
Now, when we first saw the Minions, I assumed they were created in a lab by Gru.
Yeah, these weird little yellow Twinkie monsters.
Yeah, they have, like, one or two eyes, depending on, like, how they popped out of whatever lab they were made.
And if you had told us that, we would have believed you.
Yeah, and he calls them, those are my minions, and it's not explained where they came from. I just assumed he made lab helpers.
Later it is, but not in the original film.
Later on in the series, when the Minions got a film that was just called Minions, that wasn't about Gru, they explained that these are like... they're already fully evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they crawl out of the oceans already as the Minions. And they... have this weird sort of biological imperative to assure that evil persists in the world.
They exist to be evil's henchmen. And whoever is the most evil, that's who they glom onto. And there was like a montage of like them working for like Dracula and Napoleon. And when I first saw this movie, Minions, I noted with interest that they conveniently stuck the Minions in a cave throughout all of World War II.
Well, yeah, the 20th century is gone.
Yeah.
My issue with the Despicable Me movies is they, even though they have, like, this little tiny nugget of subversion hiding inside, surrounding that little tiny nugget is this big puffball of safety.
Yeah.
Everything is really kind of safe about these movies. The character designs sometimes are really innovative and extreme. Sometimes they seem kind of generic throughout these movies. By the time we get to Despicable Me 4, he's not only adopted the three girls and has become a father to them in the first movie, but he has also remarried and has a wife, played by Kristen Wiig.
Did he remarry or just marry for the first time?
I guess he just married her for the first time.
Yeah,
but she's become a stepmother to the girls.
Yeah, and she was a super spy.
She was, yeah,
that he had
like
to team
heroic,
up with to fight spy the worst supervillain.
Yeah, worked for this sort of like MI6 organization who tried to take him down. And she eventually convinced him to come over to that side of good. Now he's a law enforcer.
Yeah.
And he has
sell out.
And he sold out. But he still has like an in with the villain, so he can infiltrate villain spaces and arrest them.
Yeah.
And the minions are just going along with it, I guess. I wish there was sort of a turncoat moment where it's like, oh, he's a hero now. Bye. We're not going to serve Gru anymore. He's not evil anymore. And so now everything's kind of safe and family friendly. All these things have always been like broadly slapstick in a way that's appealing to little kids. In a way that doesn't necessarily appeal to adults.
Yeah. It's they're bright, they're colorful, they're manic, there are a bunch of little silly goofballs. Generic entertainment appeal.
Something I do appreciate about the Minions is they're always off in their own little corner. You know, the main story will be going on, and the Minions are like literally being animated in the corner of the screen, like getting into a slap fight over a cinnamon roll or whatever they're doing.
Always whimsical.
Whimsical, but clearly disconnected from the rest of the action.
Mm.
It's almost like a Tex Avery guy, where they're just sort of throwing... Or not Tex Avery, more like Zucker Abram Zucker, where there's something kind of funny going on in the background.
Yeah, if there's free space on the screen, throw a joke in it.
Yeah, that's what the Minions were doing, in a little kid kind of a way.
Mm.
We're on to Despicable Me 4, which is the sixth film, despite its number, because there were two Minions films in there.
Yeah.
One of them had Gru in it.
Yeah, so, which really made it feel like a Gru film. But
yeah, Gru is now going back to his old supervillain high school, which is a lot like Hogwarts. It's like in this big, evil-looking castle. All
right.
And he is remembering an old high school rival of his, this French supervillain, who they have like a long-standing animosity. And this new supervillain, who's played by Will Ferrell, has figured out how to change himself into a cockroach monster. He has a human head, but a cockroach body. He's like, I'm going to take over the world as a cockroach. And Gru tries to arrest him right away. He's like, actually, I'm a good guy now. they arrest him, they take him away to prison, and Gru's like, well, you know, done's done. I have my family. He has a new son with his wife.
Oh, yeah, like Kristen Wiig. Biological
offspring. Biological, yeah. So now he's four children that he's taking care of, and of course, all of the minions. But then, cockroach villain escapes and is coming after him in a cockroach mobile who's being piloted by Sofia Vergara.
Playing herself.
Kind of.
Oh, okay.
No, she's playing like supervillain, another supervillain.
Okay, yeah.
So they have to go.
So it's like a revenge plot.
It's a revenge plot. Well, and then they have to go into witness protection. So a big part of the movie is they move into this like really affluent suburb, and they have to change their names to things like Chet and Bertha.
Oh, so it's My Blue Heaven.
It's My Blue Heaven.
Yeah. If you've never seen that, that's one of Steve Martin's best movies. It's based on the same book Goodfellas is based on, but it's all the stuff that happened after Goodfellas when a mafioso played by Steve Martin has to go into witness protection in the suburbs and how just awful fish out of water that is.
Yeah, he doesn't know how to behave. Yeah. Like,
so he ends up just...
Well, what's the address of this life? Number one, Appy Street. I don't know.
Yeah, he ends up just committing minor crimes throughout the entire thing and just pissing off local law enforcement. It is uproariously funny. Like, it's really, a legitimately really good, great movie and nobody talks about it.
So it's that shtick for a bit. Everybody has trouble fitting in to a slapstick degree. Yeah. Buildings get burned down in slapstick misadventures. Mm. Kristen Wiig is...
Misadventures?
I know. It's shenanigans, even.
How is there not like a superhero called Misadventures?
I'm sure there is.
Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah. I Googled it. I'm sure it's a dozen things.
There's another plot. There's another plot point where... the 12-year-old girl who lives next door has figured out that Gru is a supervillain. And
is he wearing a disguise?
He wears like a pink polo shirt, but he's still like.
But he still looks like Gru.
Still looks like Gru with the pointed nose and the bald head. Yeah. But the turn little plot twist there is that she finds out that he's a supervillain and wants pointers.
Yeah,
she's aspiring to be a supervillain.
Oh, so now it's apt pupil.
So yeah, there's elements of all of this. Also, in a subplot. The head of MI6, sort of the very British spy, says, well, I'm going to take all of your minions while you're in witness protection, because you can have minions around.
Aww.
And we're going to take them to spy school, and we're going to put them in essentially Captain America super soldier pods and inject them with drugs and turn them into superheroes.
Okay, you know, that's actually kind of funny.
So there's...
That's actually a good setup.
There's a quintet of superhero minions. Now, the superhero minions have no bearing on the plot whatsoever.
How could they?
There's a bit at the end where Gru is like racing off to the big climax where he's going to confront Cockroach Man, and they all get like buzzes on their belts, like, okay, it's time to go into action, and they charge off to action, and they don't show up until after the villain has been dispatched.
Right.
So they have no bearing on the end.
Did you see Minions 2, The Rise of Gru?
I did, yeah.
Didn't at the end of that, they all get like magical animal powers or some shit?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, Michelle Yeoh taught them magical animal powers.
Yeah, there's kind of like mystical animal thing.
Yeah, we're just letting that slide. They assume you don't remember it either.
No,
These movies are vapor.
They pass in, they amuse, and they just vanish.
I remember, here's the thing, I didn't see the new one, but I remember the first one, because it's pretty good.
Mm.
You know, it was novel at the time. It had a different tone, different characters, kind of interesting. The minions were kind of breakout characters, fine. Then there was the second one... Which is that?
That wasn't the one with the super villain who rode a shark into a volcano.
See, there was one
that
with
was
Benjamin.
Three.
Okay, so three was the Benjamin Bratt one.
I think so.
Yeah,
and Gru had a good twin in that one.
I thought he had the good twin in the second one.
Oh, maybe it did.
One of them, he has a good twin or an evil twin, and another one, he is Benjamin Bratt, who plays a Mexican supervillain who has like a family, and Gru was kind of jealous of his family. And the only thing I remember about that is someone's wearing like a tortilla hat with nachos.
It's like made of corn chip.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself,
and eats it.
Thinking to myself, that's awesome.
That's kind of funny. Yeah,
yeah, I would eat that hat. But like that's all I remember out of, and I've seen all of them except for this one. And that's all I remember which one had which villain.
Not that memorable. The one I remember most is the first Minions, the one without Gru.
That was pretty good.
It took place in Britain in the 60s, so there's all this, like, weird Austin Powers humor and
like
music
Sandra
references.
Bullock played this, like, the ultimate supervillain, and they were trying to, like, get on her good side.
And all I could think is, like, I'm sure kids love this British invasion film.
Yeah.
It's little kids in 2020 really love this movie.
I'm not gonna complain about that, though, because I think that's the way that these sorts of things get grandfathered in. Think about how many things that, like, as you were growing up, once you actually, like, watched the right old movie or learned about history, you realize, oh, that's what Animaniacs was making fun of.
Yeah. No, that's...
I think that's fine. I think that's part of it.
It's totally fine. I'm sure kids jibed with it.
Yeah. They probably thought it was fun, and then only later on did they realize it was an actual thing, you know?
What's his name? Not Manfredini. The creator of the Minions, who does all the voices as well.
Oh, the guy who has... Don't email us. Right. Don't email us. I will know this when I... Desmond? No.
Chris? Melodandri is his name.
Chris, okay. There you go.
Chris Melodandri. That's the name I couldn't...
I was close. I had it down to Desmond... Melodandri.
Harry Manfredini was the guy who did the music for the Friday the 13th movies. That's somebody else entirely.
Yeah.
But I like the sort of weird chittering language he's come up with for the Minions.
They're distinct creations, you know?
And, you know, they go blah and kind of fall over. I think the creators of the Rabbids video games might have something to take action over.
Well, I think, I mean, in many respects, they're basically Oompa Loompas. You know, they're weird little guys working for a weird mad genius.
I suppose.
You know,
so.
I feel like I always thought that was probably except they're yellow instead of orange.
There's a series of video games starring creatures called Rabbids with a D that are very, very similar to the Minions in terms of their comedic timing and their shtick.
And just a large gaggle of chaos misfits.
Exactly. Yeah. I like little gags of Chaos Misfits, but Despicable Me 4, just like all the others, is already vanishing in my brain.
Okay.
It's, like, vaguely entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
It's manic in a way where it's kind of washing over you rather than getting you, like, hyped up.
Yeah.
It's like,
Is it making any kind of emotional connection at all? Like,
not for a second.
It's not like you're watching How to Train Your Dragon 2 and then a major character dies and you're like, oh my god, well, this is seared into my brain forever now. I will remember this.
These movies have no such ambitions. Yeah. They're not trying to...
I didn't expect anyone to die, but I thought they might try to warm your heart.
They're not trying to... Like, it's vaguely supportive of a family unit, and the family gets to be friends at the end. A little girl is sad because she misses her pet goat. You know, that's as sad as it gets in this movie. And then that's kind of what we're looking at here. It's just another one.
Yeah.
It's another one. There's six of them now.
It feels
a lot like just an extension of the Minion product machine at this point.
Yeah.
There's a Minion Land at Universal Studios Hollywood. There's all kinds of Minion merch.
Mm-hmm.
And every time one of these movies comes out, there's just another wave of the Minion merch. It's kind of like just a way to keep the products in the public consciousness. And there's something so mercenary about that.
Oh, totally mercenary about that. And that's basically just it. We're here to prime the pump. Remind pre-existing fans, and if they're aging out, get new pre-existing fans, and just keep selling that merch. That's what we're doing. That doesn't mean that all of the material that comes out of that system is bad.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, exploitative, like the more recent Mickey Mouse cartoons, for example, are actually some of the best Mickey Mouse cartoons they've ever made. They exist to exploit the Mickey Mouse brand.
Yeah.
But they're really good. Well, you can make something good within this corporate mentality because all they really care about is putting something out.
Yeah.
If it's good, all the better, but it's not, you know.
And there are good examples of, like, interesting voices and artists going into, like, the commercial grinder and managing to churn out something that actually has some thought to it. The Lego movie is a good example. Barbie is a good example.
Sure, sure. Black Panther.
Well, Black Panther was just part of the MCU machine.
Yeah, but Ryan Coogler brought in, like, actual, like, themes in Black Futurism as an aesthetic, and I don't know if every filmmaker would have done that.
That's true. You know? A lot of the filmmakers in that series are kind of irrelevant to the series themselves. Like, the directors don't quite matter to those.
A lot of times,
it's rare that a director will actually step forth and it's like, okay, that's a Chloe Zhao film.
Yeah.
That's a Ryan Coogler film. That's a Shane Black film. All the other directors are kind of dispensable.
I think there's a few others you should give more credit to, but fair enough. Here's my question for you. What can they do with Gru and the Minions, narratively speaking, not merchandising wise, but, like, as a film, that would be actually interesting? Come up with some ideas. Well, let's get something actionable
Here's my thought. Because there is that nugget of subversion, the fact that these little creatures are there to ensure that evil happens. The problem with these movies is there's no act of unspeakable evil.
Yeah.
these aren't villains that are willing to be wicked.
Yeah.
So here's what you need to do. You need to make it a little... I know this wouldn't be good for the G-rated kid crowd, but you need to make it a little bit more chaotic and destructive.
I think there's
and it doesn't have to be adults. Like, they don't have to, like, torture people on camera.
No, you just...
But think of something like the Gremlins. They kill people.
I was literally just thinking, and then this is... Maybe you can't do a crossover between Minions and Gremlins, but what if there were evil Minions?
Yeah, which there were in one of the... They turned, like, purple monsters in one of them.
No, but I mean, like a whole, like, separate... You know, like a whole group.
Uh-huh.
You know, like there's... It's like the Jets and the Sharks.
Hmm.
I guess neither of them were evil, I suppose. But you know what I mean. Like, there's an actual, like, bad Minions that actually need to be focused on masse. You could, and then they could have their own spinoff that is a little bit more edgy.
Yeah,
just a teensy bit, like, by, like, 1%. Like, enough to, like, enough to be an improvement, but still get the G rating, you know? I guess it's PG now, but, you know.
Like, I'm thinking of Gremlins, and your Gremlins is a PG-rated film. I know it was before PG-13 was really put into practice, but that's, you know, as monsters being fed into blenders and guts spraying everywhere, but it's still sort of like a comedy.
Yeah, especially Gremlins 2.
I feel like
Gremlins 2 is a very Minions-esque kind of humor.
Yeah, Gremlins 2 is super Minions. It's just that's like total chaos.
Mm.
Do something like that. Just have... feed a minion into a meat grinder, it's dead, and everybody doesn't really mind. Oh, well, I guess that one's dead. I knocked an old woman down an elevator shaft. Oops. And, you know, just treat it like that.
I'm saying that would be the evil minions doing that. I don't think you have the actual minions doing that. You have the evil minions. Or, and then you just take the curse off of it. You still have... these ones are still safe.
Yeah.
These ones are still good for the whole family. And these ones are the PG-13 minions.
Yeah, or like a villain is like approaching a victim who's cowering on the floor with a bat. I'm going to hit you with the bat. And the minions say, no, wait. Use the mace. You know, like something like that. Something,
That's the sort of thing they used to be able to do on, like, a Disney afternoon.
Yeah.
Like, when, like, Darkwing Duck fought Negaduck.
Yeah.
Remember Negaduck? So Negaduck was the evil Darkwing Duck.
Were you talking about Megaduck or Negaduck? Because those were two different characters.
Negaduck. The evil arsenic reality version of Darkwing Duck.
Megaduck was his evil twin.
No, Well...
Megaduck was the one who looked exactly like him.
Well, which one was Negaduck?
Megaduck was like something that was like magically extracted out of his body.
Okay, well, the evil twin version. Right. The mirror universe version of Darkwing Duck. Mm. Darkwing Duck, if anyone doesn't remember, was like the Disney afternoon kids version of kind of Batman, the animated series.
But he was a duck,
But he was a duck, and he was a little bit based off more off of the Shadow, and he talked a big game, but he was actually kind of a doofus. It was a good show. He had a lot... cacophony of, or cavalcade rather, of villains, and one of them was his evil twin. And there was this one episode, and even as a kid, I watched this and I was like, that's a little dark. I'm surprised we got away with that. Darkwing Duck's evil twin had taken over the city, like had a, you know, Lex Luthor tower, and he was living at the top of it. And Darkwing Duck had to figure out how to get up there.
Hmm.
So he impersonated a delivery person and he said, "Flowers for Mr. Negaduck."
Hmm.
And the villain said, "Flowers? Ugh." And then Darkwing Duck said, "Did I say flowers? I meant skulls. Yeah, that's it. A delivery of skulls." And then Megaduck licked his lips like,
skulls. I love skulls.
Yeah, they're delicious. And I was like, that's a bit dark for Disney.
Just
a little, just right over that line. Just a nudge.
We just need to see, we need one shot of like a bunch of... minions sort of lying in a pile after having a big meal, chewing on like a human bone, implying that they've like eaten somebody.
Yeah. Give us that.
It's just
that's
like,
all we ask.
Like a little bit of edge. That's all we need. Yeah. I think a little kid could handle that.
Yeah, it's a little dark, but probably.
It's no darker than Hansel and Gretel, for goodness sake.
Yeah, we don't really make that movie anymore, do we?
I guess not.
Yeah. Or when we do, it's a dark horror film from Osgood Perkins. Which was a pretty good movie.
I didn't see Gretel and Hans.
It was pretty good. Anyway, we should move on. Next up, we have another Forkwell.
Oh, that's right.
It is despicable. Beverly Hills Cop 4, Axel F. It's not, the 4 isn't in the title.
Despicable Me, Axel F.
Yeah. Beverly Hills Cop is back. And Beverly Hills Cop is an interesting example of a franchise that got derailed by just one misstep. Because
I've heard that Beverly Hills Cop 3, which was made by John Landis before he was persona non grata.
No, after everyone hated him, but before he was publicly considered persona non grata. I'll tell you the story. So Beverly Hills Cop 1 was originally supposed to be a Sylvester Stallone movie in which he played a Detroit cop who goes to Beverly Hills to solve a murder. But Beverly Hills is very different from Detroit. That's the gag.
It was fish out of water stuff, and it was a spoof of a kind of Beverly Hills affluence that was really cartoony and over the top and lampooned in pop media a lot.
And was really taking hold as a cultural concept in the 80s as a sort of fantasy of out of touch bourgeois bullshit.
During the sort of the yuppie boom of the 1980s, Beverly Hills was seen as the epicenter of this out of touch wealth. And that's where people had, at the time, these were considered really kind of bougie, out of touch things like car phones.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
access these to were jokes. Sushi. Like those,
these were jokes yeah, at
these
the
were,
time.
These were considered really exotic. Yeah. And we got to see that and kind of mock it.
Yeah. Stallone worked on the project, rewrote the script, left the project, took his script with him, and turned that into the movie Cobra. So that's what that happened. That's co-star Brigitte Nielsen, and she'll come back in a second. Eddie Murphy took it over, and it became a bit of a broader comedy. Not a broad comedy. It's still kind of an action movie, but it's just a little bit more lighthearted. He goes to Beverly Hills. I rewatched the movie. You and I have talked a lot before about how the original Beverly Hills Cop is kind of shabby as a movie. You know, it's basically a loose structure on which Eddie Murphy can riff. Mm. It's a little better than I remembered. I rewatched it and I was like, okay, you know what? This hangs together a bit better than I thought. And the thing that I think works really well about it is that Eddie Murphy, Axel Foley, he is not just in Beverly Hills going, ha ha, those fools. Hmm. He's actually engaging with people. He actually meets people. He likes people. He becomes fast friends with other cops. It's actually a really good buddy picture in a lot of ways. But his great weapon is because Beverly Hills is such a town that is so concerned about image and, not
opulence.
All he has to do to take someone down is make a scene. Mm. So he goes to a country club and makes a scene. All of a sudden, the villain doesn't have any recourse because no one else would do that. He breaks all the rules of Beverly Hills. And that works. That's something that follows along to Beverly Hills Cop 2, 3, and to a lesser extent, 4. So Beverly Hills Cop 1 helped Eddie Murphy become a huge star. It's his movie more than anything else. I had never seen Beverly Hills Cop 2 until this year, because I knew this movie was coming out. And I knew that Tony Scott directed it. Mm. And I knew that Tony Scott is a very different filmmaker from Martin Brest, who did the original and also did Midnight Run. Beverly Hills Cop 2, if you'll let me use a technical term, fucks. Beverly Hills Cop 2 actually holds up really good. First off, Tony Scott shoots the shit out of it.
He's more about photography, I think, than anything.
Perhaps, but this is a good marriage of material for him. He understands the opulence of Beverly Hills while also making it look sinister. Mm. He manages to capture both. So the movie has, and the movie is a lot less funny. Eddie Murphy is still Eddie Murphy, but it's less of an excuse for him to riff and more of an action movie where he's taking down people who are involved in a series of heists led by Brigitte Nielsen, who has some of the best sunglasses in movie history throughout the entire film. Along the way, he re-teams up with his best friend cops from the first movie and Judge Reinhold, who seemed like the sort of dopey, naive guy. It turns out that in the interim has gone somewhat mad and has a house full of guns he's, but in a funny way, everyone says we really gotta talk.
There's a joke in this new movie where he's a big fan of Rambo First Blood Part 2.
There's a bunch of Rambo references throughout these movies as sort of a gag about Stallone leaving, so that's consistent. Beverly Hills Cop 2 is really, really good. Genuinely good. It holds up great. I was surprised. Beverly Hills Cop 3 is a huge sack of shit. So,
which they also comment on in this new movie.
They do. They have a bit where they look at Axel Foley's file and they talk about all the other times he went to Beverly Hills in 84, 87, and 94. And when they talk about 94, it's like, that was not your best work.
Although, in this movie, he has an adult daughter. And there's even a bit where she asks him, he's been really unengaged with her life. Evidently, he had a falling out with their mother.
Yeah.
Her mother, and they didn't communicate a lot. So she
And
she, it seems kind of unfair to Axel because he kept saying, you kept saying no and pushing me away. And her only recourse was you didn't try harder. It's like, well, you kept pushing me away. How, when how...
when she's a little kid, there's no excuse. Yeah. As an adult, maybe.
But she's like, how old am I? And he's able to name her birthday right away.
Yeah.
And she says that she's 32, which means she would have been born before the events of Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Exactly. Which means, and considering that she has, like, memories of her dad, like, before he moved away, Beverly Hills Cop 3, which is the only film in the series where he has a love interest.
Okay.
He was cheating on her mom. That's canon. Oh, so that's what that would mean.
She's not the mom?
It's not. It's, no, because they meet 2 years after she was born.
Oh, I guess so.
So it can't be her mom.
Or they had already broken up at that point, and he just never mentioned it.
But it's implied based on, like, when she says he left after she was such and such an age.
Mm.
It's implied that they were still together. Maybe they had an arrangement? I don't know. I will say this. First off, again, Beverly Hills Cop 3, the word tepid comes to mind. It's just it's just a flat glass of water. It's just nothing interesting. They have a high concept. It's like evil afoot at Disneyland, but it's not Disneyland. Which you could do a lot with. That's nowhere fucking near Beverly Hills, but okay. But no, it's not funny. The action sucks. They completely forget about all of Judge Reinhold's character development. It's just a flat, crap film. And it killed the franchise dead. No one wanted any part of it after that. It was done.
Yeah.
And honestly, good riddance at that point. It was that bad. But the thing that I thought was interesting, and watching this new one, again, Eddie Murphy has only one love interest on camera throughout this entire series. The love story in 3 is very chaste and perfunctory.
Hmm.
They kind of hit it off a bit. He asks her out to dinner. Action shenanigans happen. And at the end of the movie, she's like, oh, well, maybe we could go on the Tunnel of Love later. And he's like, oh, that'd be fun. And, like, that's it. That's all the romance Axel ever gets throughout all 4 movies.
Yeah.
Which in the Western canon of mainstream cinema is an aberration. They shoehorn in love plots.
Yeah.
Wherever, even if they don't make any sense, they will shoehorn it in. And they never did with Axel. And I thought that was interesting. And I did some research and I saw that there have been some articles, some sort of reevaluations, arguing that maybe Axel is gay.
Oh.
Which, maybe,
Doesn't read, but...
But there's a line in Beverly Hills Cop 4...
Mm.
Where he says, and he doesn't say it like it's a joke, like it's a punchline. He just says it. He says, I'm celibate.
Yeah.
And honestly, that tracks.
If he could be asexual, that's the only indication we get.
I think that he flat out says it, and if you look at, there is no evidence throughout the rest of the movies, other than a brief, mild flirtation, that he is romantically interested in anyone. There, even that's the true, scenes where he goes to a strip club, he does it for male bonding.
He doesn't say or do anything, like, lascivious.
Not but, really, no.
I really like her boobs, like anything right, like
he,
that.
He remarks upon Brigitte Nielsen being very statuesque by saying, and I'm not going to say it because it's a rude word, but, like, no, that is a very tall B word. He's just saying she's tall.
Yeah.
He's not going, oh, I would very much like to sex her. Like, no, he's not engaging with any character. And I think that's interesting, and I think we need to talk about that more, because Axel Foley is the lone asexual, like, action
proclaimed
hero.
Asexual action hero.
Kind of, like, proclaimed in, like, this movie. That's kind of cool.
A lot of action heroes are asexual, like on this side of James Bond, that is.
Yeah.
In a lot of PG-13 action pictures, they don't have time for romance. So you could,
or if they do, it's just flirty. There's no actual, sexual chemistry.
There's been a lot of ink spilled over the MCU and how nobody has sex in those movies. Nobody has romances in those movies. Mm-hmm. They're like some Family Guys, but there's not a lot of on-screen, like, kissing or displays of affection.
The most I think we ever had was in The Incredible Hulk, which was, like, the second movie.
Yeah. I'm
doing
this for the woman I love, or I'm sorry I've lost the woman I love.
But have argued that makes them immature. I've argued for a while, I think that makes them asexual. They're like asexual fantasies which is interesting.
I would have appreciated it if that was in the text.
Yeah, I know.
If somebody said, I'm not interested in sex, or I don't have sex with other people because that's the way I am.
Yeah.
If they had said something very explicit about
even
it,
just one or two,
that would have been better representation.
But here he says it.
Here he says it. So,
kudos, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't have a lot of those, of, like, any kind of queer spectrum action heroes, just in general.
Uh-huh.
Even the Jason Statham Transporter movies, where the suggestion was, and the intended suggestion of the first two films was that he was gay.
Uh-huh.
when that came out, like when people, some of that came out in an interview, they backtracked so fucking hard and made him as hetero as humanly possible.
Had a threesome with two women later
on. Yeah, yeah, it got really, really embarrassing. They just, they couldn't handle it. They didn't think anyone was ready for it. But here they're kind of saying it. I think that's neat. I wish the movie was better, but I think that's at least novel.
Again, I wish that were, maybe came up more than once instead of just like one little snippet of dialogue.
Well, it's not really relevant to the text.
I suppose not.
You know, it doesn't have to come up.
Now, interesting angle.
It's an angle.
Interesting representation.
I haven't seen anyone really talking about it. And granted, I'm ace, so like I might be more attuned to it.
Radar is a little bit more. Yeah,
but I'm not projecting that where I don't see it. Like it's not like I'm really reaching.
I think it's a fair read.
I think in this case, it's a very fair read.
I didn't see the first Beverly Hills Cop when I was a kid, with a lot of people my age.
You didn't grow up with it.
I saw it when I was in my 30s, and by the time I had seen it, Beverly Hills Cop was such a phenomenon. Oh, it was huge. Such a huge, huge hit, and it was really declared Eddie Murphy as the cinema presence, and it was huge for 20 years.
One of the most hummable movie themes.
Yeah, by Harold Faltermeyer. Which my sister could play on the piano.
Yeah, it's easy to play. Yeah, it's fun.
She took piano lessons. She learned how to play the Axel F theme. But this idea of cop out of water, does funny shenanigans, vaguely solves a crime, and then there's also action in there as well. Mm-hmm. Eddie Murphy was also in 48 Hours, which did something really similar in this kind of mismatched buddy cop thing.
Yeah, Eddie Murphy is not the typical cop. Except that when he was a criminal helping a cop, but whatever. Yeah.
It became so popular that it immediately spawned a spate of imitators. Mm-hmm. All the cop movies that came out throughout the 1980s were kind of riffs on Beverly Hills.
A lot of wacky cop films.
Yeah. Even Lethal Weapon is arguably Beverly Hills Cop riff.
I'm sure it was easier to get it made because of Beverly Hills Cop, at least. Yeah, yeah.
And all of the films that came after it kind of improved on the formula a little bit. They actually bothered to focus on the action and the plot a little bit more, so they felt more spectacular entertainments.
Yeah, Beverly Hills Cop 1 has two action sequences. Mm-hmm. One in the first scene and one in the last scene.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of action in it. The plot is a little difficult to follow.
Yeah.
Axel Foley is entertaining, but it doesn't feel like we're doing anything really revolutionary with this kind of riffing and making fun of Beverly Hills culture. It's already been outstripped. It's been outdone. Some would even say by its own sequel. I hadn't seen Beverly Hills Cop 2, but yeah.
I would say they're different films in a lot of ways, but I do think Beverly Hills Cop 2 is a better film.
Yeah. So when I'm watching Beverly Hills Cop, I'm I understand why this was a hit, but there are so many better films than this.
Yeah.
It was really daring and kind of even edgy at the time. It was really kind of crass at the time. Mm-hmm. It was seen as something really out on the edge that was doing something new with the genre, almost even inventing a new genre.
Yeah.
And this is where I'm going to compare Beverly Hills Cop to what we call classic rock. Keep in mind, when pop songs come out, and they're kind of made by young, angry punks who have something kind of daring and edgy to say.
Yeah.
And whatever age you are, dear listener, think back to the music that came out when you were 16. That stuff.
Yeah.
That was when you were really kind of zeroed in on the music pop culture and you were getting something that was more sexual, more aggressive, more angsty, more emotional than the generation that came before it.
Or at least it seemed that way to you because it was your generation.
Yeah, because it was your generation. Yeah. And in many cases, it was. It was pushing things forward a little.
A lot of the time, yeah.
And now, remember that same music.
Yeah.
And if you're old enough, you're going to remember the time when you heard that music for the first time on the classic rock station.
Yeah, it's a weird moment.
It's like when I first heard Pearl Jam on the classic rock station. It's like, okay, time has passed.
Yeah.
This is now not my generation. Old now. Yeah, we're older now. My generation isn't, calling the shots anymore. And at some point, that same really dark, hard, edgy music, when it starts playing in reruns on the comfort stations, the classic rock stations.
When you start hearing it in a commercial for an unrelated thing.
Yeah, when you hear this, for an air freshener product, or you hear Devo at Whole Foods.
Yeah.
It's like, you know that the edge is gone off of that stuff.
It doesn't mean it's bad, it's just people aren't oh my God, people aren't shocked by it anymore. People aren't taken aback.
In fact, the opposite has happened.
Yeah.
People are now comforted by that.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of warm and soft now to hear Devo, which is weird.
Yeah.
This is, to me, what Axel F. is.
Agreed.
It's it's taking something that was once really edgy and trying to regurgitate it 40 years later for the sake of comfort.
Yeah.
So even when Eddie Murphy, who is 63...
Mm-hmm. And looks good, by doesn't the way. Look carries an action movie well, honestly, for a 63-year-old.
He still he hasn't aged since he turned 45. Like, he's just...
If that.
Continuing to chug along.
Yeah.
When he's making these kind of, like, edgy jokes or he's cussing a lot, it's, like, something really familiar now.
Yeah. Oh,
and they play like, the Neutron Dance. And
oh, they play all the old
1983 pop hits are on the soundtrack again.
I think Lil Nas X does, like, a remix.
Lil Nas X is the new. And there's, like, I think Olivia Rodrigo and some other young pop stars also on the soundtrack. Yeah. And we're telling a very... very predictable story about police corruption in Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
It's just as confusingly told as the original movie, where there seem to be pieces missing. Like, it wasn't until the end of the movie that I learned what happened to the Judge Reinhold character, who's gone for a big portion of the movie.
Yeah, they kind of forget.
And then he shows up at the end, is like, oh wait, how did he get there?
Why would they even?
Why is he back in this movie at this point in the movie?
Wouldn't
and
it
why
make more sense if he was
him?
Dead? Like, it's weird. Yeah. So the plot of the movie, real fast, in a nutshell: Axel Foley is still a cop in Detroit, and his daughter is working a case. She's a lawyer now in Beverly Hills, a criminal defense lawyer, who is defending a guy who is accused of killing an undercover cop, but he says he didn't do it and someone else did. She believes him, she's pushing it, and then right as soon as she takes the case, the bad guys, like, trap her in her car, hook her car up to, like, a tow truck, and, like, dangle her off a building, you know, real subtle-like, so that people won't know there's a conspiracy afoot. Because after that happens, if she drops the case, are you telling me everyone's gonna go, there was a probably unconnected events? The villain plan makes no sense, but in any case... there are actual corrupt cops. Judge Reinhold is looking after Axel's daughter. He says, Axel, you got to get over here. She's in trouble. He comes over. Judge Reinhold has already been kidnapped. And now he's got to find Judge Reinhold and save his daughter and come to terms with his estranged daughter and do all the usual Axel Foley shtick. Mm-hmm. Also, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is in the film as kind of the new Judge Reinhold. He's a good cop. He's working for the Beverly Hills Police Department. He's a good cop, in air quotes. He's working for the Beverly Hills Police Department.
I appreciate that they shot the actual Beverly Hills Police Department Beverly Hills.
They've done that consistently, which I appreciate. In fact, they actually made an effort to shoot in real locations in Los Angeles, like a lot of real locations. They fudge the geography a lot. There's a scene where Axel Foley walks out of a hospital in Beverly Hills and crosses the street to Norm's, which is at best half a mile away. But
Cedars-Sinai is within walking distance of
the
Norm's.
It is not across
Canada.
The street, and they specifically say it's showed that it's across the street.
Well, then they cut to a reverse angle, and they're like downtown. That's like a little that's
that
the
happens
fudge.
A lot. There's a
but
scene...
I buy that someone would walk out of Cedars and walk over to Norm's.
It's fine. I'm saying they fudge the geography. That's all. But, but it's one of those things where we know LA.
Yeah.
There's another one where Judge Reinhold's like private detective office is. I guess they made an arrangement with the exact same guys who I go to fix my computer.
Oh.
Like, they have the exact... it's in that building. I think it's in the exact same office. And that's in... that was... I think they moved, but that was in, like, the Mid-Wilshire... not Mid-Wilshire. It's in,
It's over on Sunset.
It's on Brentwood.
It was underneath that, the Syphilis Volcano billboard, which is on Sunset, I think.
No, part of that shot was. The actual shot, like, inside the building, like, inside this little, courtyard. That is just on the cusp of Brentwood.
Oh, okay.
And then as soon as he leaves that building, all of a sudden, he's on a street in Beverly Hills. And I'm like, nope.
I know this film actually got an award for its location scouting.
Already?
Yeah, like...
all right.
Because they actually bothered to shoot in Beverly Hills, so good for them.
And listen,
clearly it's not Toronto.
Oh,
That's fine.
I appreciate that. Here's my point. This isn't a critique. This is a mild distraction because I live here.
Mm.
If you've never lived in a place where they've actually filmed, like, movies or TV shows, you might not know what this is like, but if you've, like, if they've ever, like, shot a movie in your hometown, like, and used various locations, and you're, like, really excited, and then you go see the movie, and it's neat, but you realize is that no one else in the audience, or even in the filmmakers, give a shit about what is where in town.
Yeah.
there was a place called, there was a film called The Man from Elysian Fields with Andy Garcia and Mick Jagger. And they filmed at a bookstore, sadly no longer there. It was called Rizzoli's. It was the best bookstore in LA County, if you asked me. And it was in Pasadena. And they shoot a couple of scenes in the store, but they use the exterior of the store to be the exterior of a restaurant in a different scene. No one else is going to give a shit, but I'm distracted. That's all I'm saying. But anyway, Gaxel gets in his old shenanigans. And it's reasonably entertaining. Like, it's definitely better than Beverly Hills Cop 3, like, by a long shot. But it's very formulaic.
Yeah,
it's very generic.
Well, there's also
Of good helicopter stunt. I'll give him that.
It's kind of cute. I'm really frustrated by, and this is a lot of classic, it felt like a pandemic filming, where there were a lot of, like, close-ups and a lack of establishing shots, a lack of wide shots. Where you had, like, a bunch of characters really kind of giving you a sense of, like, the place in the scene. It was all just these tight close-ups.
Mm-hmm.
The running scenes and the action sequences were really annoying because they're clearly cutting around Eddie Murphy's running double.
Oh, yeah. No, when Eddie Murphy does something cool, you will not see Eddie Murphy's face.
Yeah.
Which is fine. He's 63. He's 63. I'm not going to complain.
I don't want him to, like, sprint up a staircase 8 times.
Yeah, he's not Jet Li. I don't expect him to be able to do that at a greater age. It's totally fine, but it's clear.
Yeah,
you know.
But that in to do that, there's a lot of, like, close-ups and editing, which lends an element of chaos to a scene.
Mm-hmm.
It robs scenes of, like, kind of a fundamental clarity, which I feel is required in, like, a mainstream action picture like that.
And that lack of clarity makes it feel a little less impressive as well, because it just feels like they just found it in an editing room.
Yeah, the director of this film is an Australian director of TV commercials.
Mm-hmm.
This is his first feature. His name is Mark Molloy. And he took over from the team that ended up doing Bad Boys Ride or Die.
Oh, yeah, I remember
And
that,
they were also... they left this film to go do Batgirl, and that film was canceled.
Yeah.
So they did Bad Boys instead.
Canceled. They finished it. It was in post-production when they decided never to show it to any human being ever
again. So that movie's gone.
And then they made this hit Bad Boys movie, and it's like, oh man, what if you had another movie from these people? In a popular franchise starring a recent Oscar winner, Brendan Fraser. That was going to be his big post-Oscars role.
I mean, I can't get mad just because I haven't seen the movie. I can't get mad that we
haven't seen the movie. Maybe it's good, maybe it's bad.
I can get mad on their behalf because, you know, a lot of people put a lot of hard work
into principle, the movie should be seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the backstory there.
But he doesn't shoot it like a commercial, you know. He's not bringing, like, that kind of over-stylized Michael Bay-ishness to it. He's actually trying to shoot it like a real movie.
Yeah.
But it does also feel very light and it's substantial.
Yeah.
It's inoffensive the same way Despicable Me 4 is inoffensive, even though it's an R-rated film with a lot of cusses and violence in it. It feels really, like, boomer comfort food.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make it offensive, but it doesn't make it very memorable.
No, and they go through a lot of the motions without really understanding the motions sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier that, like, Axel Foley's, like, big secret weapon in Beverly Hills was that he didn't give a shit how he was perceived, and all the villains do.
Mm.
So they'll be in, like, a big, like, oh, this villain is getting an award for all of his philanthropic needs, and Axel goes up on stage and say, this guy is a murderer.
Mm.
Holy shit. Like, you just really threw him under the bus, and now he has to deal with you. And now, you've brought him out into the open. He didn't think anyone would be crazy enough to do that. They have that scene here where, like, he's at a party and the bad guy is there. The bad guy's played by Kevin Bacon.
Mm.
And
who's excellent. He's doing...
Oh, he's good.
He's bringing it all.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin Bacon has never been bad, I don't think.
He's been in bad stuff that didn't make the most of him, but he's never done a bad job. He's always a good actor.
I hated They/Them. That's interesting concept. Terrible script.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't his fault.
But it wasn't, he was like the villain in that one too, but that's not his fault.
Yeah. So here he's the villain, he's a perfectly good villain, and they do the scene where Axel, like, worms his way into a big fancy nightclub party, and then he has the talk with Kevin Bacon, he confronts him about all of his evil deeds, but he doesn't make a public scene of it, they just sort of have a talk about the plot, and then Axel leaves.
Hmm.
No, that's not why that scene is there.
That's
not the functionality, that's not why we're here. You just kind of missed the point of that.
There was one subversion of the cliches that I liked.
Oh, yeah?
Because one of Axel's shticks is that he does, like, impersonations. He pretends he's to be somebody else when he goes to, like, a fancy Beverly Hills. And they're trying to kowtow to who he's saying he is. Like, I'm a famous person. How dare you not kowtow to me?
In the original film, he in order to get, like a discount on a hotel in Beverly Hills, he pretended to be, like, a Rolling Stone interviewer.
Mm.
And when they wouldn't give him, like, a room... for like because they were all booked up, he said, "Oh, I see how it is." And he said they were being racist.
Mm.
And then they gave him a room. It's like, okay, we'll give it to you at a discounted rate. It's $250 a night, which at the time was absurd.
Yes.
And Axel was like, "Great, what a discount."
There's a subversion in this movie where he tries to do that same shtick. Yes, I'm going to this hot fancy hotel, and I'm a very famous. You know what? I'm tired. I can't do the shtick. I'm going to drop the face. I'll just pay for
whatever it is. I'll pay. Yeah. Which is a funny joke.
Yeah.
It's like that bit in, I think it's Fast Five when they're like, oh, we have to go get a bunch of cars. So we'll win them in a car race. So they go to the big car race.
There's a hard cut after the car race.
And then they just all have their cars. Yeah. We know what was going to happen.
We don't need that.
We don't need,
anymore.
I know it is.
And,
it's not really that much of a disappointment.
The other thing that really made me laugh was actually a role with the cliches because they had essentially the Cameron Mitchell character, the cantankerous old cop guy.
Yeah.
The cliche, which was kind of birthed with Beverly Hills Cop, but also,
I think it's before that, but yeah.
Yeah, the one that bangs on the desk and says, you're off the case. I guess there were like 70s cop movies that did that too.
Yeah, he was not the
some blaxploitation movies. But, the actor who plays it is every bit that character. They do nothing to put a spin on that character. Mm-hmm. He says, I hate my wife and I'm taking antacids.
And that's Taggart. He was one of the guys from the first movie.
And actually gets to say things like, give me a badge and your gun. You're off the case. And, he has played so straight. It felt like they cracked him out of amber. It's like they cloned this guy from some long dead cliches. They just brought him back.
The funny thing was that the original Beverly Hills Cop had a character who absolutely fit into that. Axel was like Detroit police captain.
Yeah.
And also one who didn't, played by Ronnie Cox. And I actually love Ronnie Cox's introduction in the original Beverly Hills Cop because that guy who's this movie had been, he had retired and then he came back and they made him captain. I don't know if that's how that works, but he wasn't available for Beverly Hills Cop 3, so whatever. But he is interrogating Axel Foley. Axel Foley is being completely unhelpful and kind of impersonating someone. And he punches Axel Foley in the middle of the police precinct. And Ronnie Cox, his commanding officer, sees that and immediately says, hey, in my office now. And we see them arguing for a minute. And then Ronnie Cox comes in and said, what this man did to you was completely unacceptable. And if you want to press charges, I will right now. And I was like, wow, that's kind of awesome, actually. What a great example to set. But then the point of the scene turned out to be Axel was disappointed in them because where I come from, cops don't press charges on other cops. And I'm like, maybe you should. That's not behavior we should be. Anyway. We've been dancing around it. The original, this new film is an adequate trip down memory lane.
Yeah.
That's what it's there for. That's all it's trying to do.
It's not making any comments.
No.
We're bringing back Axel Foley to no real end. Just he's stuck to the same stuff.
You've got some characters in there who do some of the fun old stuff. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is there to be a guy. He really doesn't have anything to really contribute other than he's around.
I'd say he's like the youth vote, but he's 40. You know,
I mean, he's good. He's always good.
Well, I've always liked Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Yeah. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
I'll say this. This is a lot more tolerable than watching an 80-year-old Harrison Ford try to be an action star.
Yeah.
We're cutting around 63-year-old Eddie Murphy's running scenes, but I'm convinced that he could still do it.
Yeah, he's
bringing energy and interest into this
role. Oh, he's fully engaged. He was not fully engaged in Beverly Hills Cop 3. He was going through the fucking motions of Beverly Hills Cop 3. Here, he really seems to want to be here today.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy is one of our more, like, honestly, one of our more amiable, energetic, and oftentimes genuinely subversive comedic actors throughout his entire career. He also has some really dark patches where he did some really unforgivably homophobic humor in some of his early routines.
In stand-up stuff.
Yeah, which is unacceptable, but that isn't the majority of his career. The majority of his career is actually as an interesting movie star. But there came a time when he just started doing not interesting stuff, and you could tell his heart wasn't in it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's kind of why his star faded. He started to do a bunch of sort of high concept family friendly comedies.
Yeah,
I think just because he wanted to do family friendly movies.
I think Dr. Doolittle broke that. Like he came back. His career was like kind of on the outs for a little bit in the early '90s. He hadn't had a big hit since like Boomerang, and then he did The Nutty Professor. Which was an unexpected giant hit. That had Oscar buzz. Like people thought he was going to be nominated for Best Actor at that time.
Because kids were playing multiple roles.
No, and he was really good. Yeah. He was really good in that movie. And so that was such a huge mega hit. It pushed him back up to the top again.
If you go back and watch the original, well, I guess it's not the original, but
the Eddie Murphy version
of The Nutty Professor. Yeah. There's a bit where he turns into Buddy Love. He takes the potion, he turns into Buddy Love, and he takes a woman on a date. Mm-hmm. And they go to see Dave Chappelle.
Oh, yeah.
And he beats up Dave Chappelle on stage.
I know.
It's like, okay, this is a hero moment, weirdly,
aged weirdly, yeah. Yeah. But anyway, after that, he started doing a bit more, like, sort of mainstreamy kind of stuff. Yeah. And to varying degrees of success. Mm-hmm. And, like, through most of the 2000s, with the exception of Dreamgirls, which was supposed to be his legitimizer, and he got an Oscar nomination for it, and of course he didn't win. Honestly, he would have been fine if he did. He's very good in that movie.
But he was also doing Dr. Doolittle, and he did Meet Dave, which nobody went to go see. And then he did a film called 1,000 Words, which was kind of the end for him for a while. I think he took on a career hiatus, because that one also tanked.
Yeah. I don't know if this was exactly when he came back.
And then it was also Norbit in there, which was a notorious bomb.
Yeah. He did Dolomite Is My Name, which is, as far as I'm concerned, should be considered a modern classic.
It's pretty brilliant.
It's really legitimately great. He should have been Oscar nominated for that. I stand by that. That movie
should have
at least...
Wesley Snipes should have gotten an Oscar nomination for that one.
Screenplay as well. At least those three things, minimum. That's a genuinely great motion picture. So, you know, I like seeing him engaged in material. This is a perfectly good... sort of like little victory lap, and it does a service, if nothing else, of not having Beverly Hills Cop 3 be the final film with this franchise.
Yes.
Because what an ignominious end. We should move on.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
The last film that we're reviewing this week is a film called Maxine. Maxine is spelled with 3 X's because it stars Mia Goth as her character from the movie X, which was a sort of a riff on 70s horror movies about a independent, making their own movie, group of pornographers trying to shoot a porno movie at a cabin on couple's farm.
Distant Texan property.
Yeah. And it turns out that the old lady who lives on the farm is a homicidal maniac. Hmm. And she kills almost all of them, except for Mia Goth's character, who is a badass.
And she's not the main character of X.
It's kind of a Ripley and Alien.
There's a director
kind of,
and there's the photographer, and the photographer's girlfriend is played by Jenna Ortega. And there's
Brittany Snow is another porn star. It's a big cast.
There's a lot of interesting conversations in that movie about sort of the function of pornography in the 1970s and how healthy it really is and how important it is as sort of a medium unto itself.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of talk about sort of the power of independent filmmaking.
Sure.
It's actually about sort of the tenacity of independent filmmaking. And then it turns into a slasher movie and it becomes way less interesting real fast.
And a slasher movie that kind of annoys me because most of the horror isn't even from the murders. It's from, ew, old people.
Yeah.
Which gets old real fast. Like,
and,
it's all you really have for the second half of that
movie.
And the
old woman is named Pearl. Mm-hmm. She's also played by Mia Goth in, like, extensive old age makeup. And the idea behind that, and it's frustrating hearing Ty West talk about this in interviews, because the only reason he did that is because he liked the idea of old age makeup. Like, he likes effects makeup. So he wanted to have a younger actor play this old character rather than just cast an older actress.
Right.
So Mia Goth said, well, I'm here, I'll do that. And so she played two roles in the movie.
But then they reverse engineered that into a pretty cool idea, which was a prequel that they filmed at the same time and released later that same year called Pearl, that was about Pearl when she was Mia Goth's age in the 1910s. Yeah. And she was a young burgeoning homicidal maniac, but her dream was to get to Hollywood and make something real of herself. And also she had a barely checked libido. Like, she passes like a scarecrow in a field and she has to stop and fuck it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just...
Like, she has a libido. She wants to be sort of free of this little town.
Yeah, especially her domineering, ultra-religious parents.
Religious mother, and her father is disabled, and she kind of resents that she has to take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
And
I feel like she loves him, but she does resent that he's keeping her home.
Yeah. And so she wants to... And she goes to the movies. Rather curiously, there's footage in Pearl of the earliest known example of hardcore pornography.
Yeah, she befriends
the earliest known movie.
She befriends the projectionist who has
Who's played by the next Superman.
Yeah, which is fun. and I buy it. I think he's definitely out of town. Anyway, Pearl is exceptional.
I think
Pearl is a genuinely great horror movie.
Pearl is an excellent movie. It was one of my favorite movies that year. I don't like X. I think X is pretty bad.
I think X is just okay.
It's like really unfocused. I feel like the horror isn't scary. I feel like it says in its text what it's about, and it's so like mawkish about it that it becomes less interesting once it's been said.
I feel like retroactively after you see Pearl adds some more weight to it.
A little bit.
Because she's coming from.
But Pearl is great without X.
Agreed.
You know, we don't need that.
No, agreed.
I think the big secret to Pearl was that Mia Goth also co-wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave herself a dance number. Mm. She gave herself an excellent monologue at the end.
Wonderful
Which
monologue.
They shoot in a single take, which is really great.
Oh, she's incredible in that. She has a great... The final shot, which I won't ruin for anybody if you haven't seen it. Awesome. And it's all Mia Goth. Mm. And she nails it. It's such a good
role.
So that
is like the Mia Goth showcase. Yeah.
And it's kind of... The one thing I will say is those two movies create a bit of a dyad where we see two versions of this person throughout history in kind of a sort of thematic sense who are clearly unconcerned about killing people. Maxine doesn't want to do it all willy-nilly, but she'll do it if she needs to. And they both want the same thing. But Maxine went out and got it. And Pearl didn't.
Maxine, now we're finally skipping ahead. We're back to Maxine, the Mia Goth character from X.
Mm-hmm.
But it's now 1985.
In this movie,
She's made it to Los Angeles. And she's been an adult film actress for all this time. But now she wants to, quote, go legit. She wants to go into non-adult features.
Yeah, and she's very famous in the porn world. Mm. She's very successful. Like,
and
people recognize her.
It's 1985, so the idea of... an adult film actress sort of crossing over to horror movies isn't so wild an idea.
No, it happened more often in the 80s.
And, but when she's there, because of the events of X, there's like ghosts following, not literal ghosts, but like the violence is something she's been outrunning for a while.
Yeah.
And it's finally catching up with her, another Kevin Bacon film. Kevin Bacon plays sort of this really seedy private detective.
Yeah.
Kevin Bacon is such a talented actor. I wish he could play, like, warm, friendly characters from time to time. Because he's so good at playing villains and sleazebags, he gets cast in those kinds of roles a lot.
He used to play them more And I feel like he got more rewards when he played interesting, gross guy. I feel like there was this period in the mid-90s where he made the switch, where he played this absolute monster in the movie Sleepers. And it's not a... He wasn't a bad guy. He was a guy who was destroyed by the criminal criminal system, but...
Murder in the First,
which I think if that movie
I haven't seen Murder in the First.
If that movie had come out at the end of the year instead of, like, January or February, which is when it came out, he would have got an Oscar nomination. He's really great in that
movie. Yeah. Kevin Bacon is a very good actor.
He turned a corner in the 90s and did more interesting stuff.
He plays a private detective who's on her trail and has, like, sort of... essentially,
a mysterious benefactor.
Yeah, a mysterious benefactor has hired me to sort of point out to you that you've done these acts of violence.
Yeah, they leave the film that they were making in X, this pornographic film, they shot some of it, and it is now police evidence, and they leave the VHS on her doorstep
to remind her,
we can connect you to these murders, then destroy your career before it gets going. So she's under threat.
Yeah, there's a heck of a lot going on
in this
movie.
There's a lot of movie, yeah.
Yeah, there's Elizabeth Debicki plays the film director, who says, you know, I need you to step up and actually play this role, and she's actually really devoted to it.
It's a mainstream movie, but it's a sequel to a horror movie that a lot of people are protesting in a very satanic panic kind of way. And also, there's a serial killer in town. Literally, there was the Night Stalker at the time, and they name check him. But this movie, and I'm glad they didn't, because I think it would have been gross. The villain of the movie isn't the Night Stalker.
No.
It's another serial killer who is copycatting the Night Stalker, who is obsessed with Maxine.
And there's the cliche pair of cops played by Michelle Monaghan and Bobby Cannavale.
Yeah,
who play pretty off the rack kind of cop characters.
I like Bobby Cannavale because he's playing a guy who was like a failed actor, and every time he talks to someone, he's putting on a bit.
Yeah.
Like, he's doing, like, an improv exercise, and sometimes he fucks it up, and it's kind of funny.
The satanic panic thing is, like, kind of floating around the edges. Clearly, Ty West is trying to not really make a movie, because the movie doesn't cohere in any kind of meaningful way. It's just a lot of this nonsense.
Yeah.
But he's trying to make a very general pastiche to several films at once. A very particular type of mid-80s sleaze cinema that included films like Hollywood Boulevard, Angel and Avenging Angel especially,
Vice Squad
with Wings Hauser.
These movies that were shot in L.A. on, like, Sunset Boulevard, Hollywood Boulevard, but in, like, the sleaziest, skeeziest parts of it.
Yeah, they were all typically about sex workers or serial killers or both. Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of, like, sort of outsider characters in these movies, too, like trans characters who were treated respectfully in these films. Like, it's an interesting way of cinema that isn't...
Strip to Kill is also a big influence in this movie.
Yeah. He's creating that vibe, and it feels like he couldn't decide which one he wanted to, like, make the centerpiece, like, drive the story forward. So he just shoved all three together kind of willy-nilly.
Yeah, so that...
And it doesn't quite work as a narrative.
It feels like every day in this movie is, like, 96 hours. Like, so much is happening to these characters. And good for Mia Goth.
She's great.
Because Mia Goth is really trying to ground it and make it seem like there's an arc going on, but there's so many things going on.
Yeah.
And she's being pulled in so many different directions. And like, when the Avenging Angel movie starts, she's a certain kind of a character. Then when the detective story starts, she kind of withdraws and becomes a different kind of a character.
Yeah, yeah.
So it becomes really inconsistent.
By the time we hit the climax, it really does feel like she's like, I could just walk away or I could finish the movie.
Yeah.
And she decides to finish the movie in a way that just feels kind of arbitrary.
Well, and when it finally is revealed, like, what's going on, who the true villain of this piece
no
was.
No spoilers.
No, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it does come out of left field. It's not something you could predict necessarily.
In retrospect, they played fair. I will say that. If you watch the movie, it's
set
around.
Up and there's payoff, but it doesn't feel significant.
Well, it doesn't feel like it's the end of the rest of the movie that we saw.
Yeah.
It feels like they set up this movie for a couple of scenes, then they did these two other movies, and then in the last act, after they ran through those other movies, all they had left was this one movie that they forgot to really do much with.
Yeah.
And now we're there for 20 minutes.
I was reminded of Inherent Vice, where there's like three cases going on.
Yeah.
And that's like, and the main character is Stone, so I think that we're a little lost as part of the story.
Yeah, but he's also overwhelmed and it's all stuff he can't control.
But at the end of the movie, it's like, okay, like he kind of like has to reconnoiter and he hears a narrator in his head. It's like, okay, you have like three cases. Choose the one that would be make the most satisfying ending to this movie and do that.
Yeah.
That's all we can really do. Yeah.
It's like there's one you cannot control over this. You're just some stoner guy.
Yeah.
But you can help one thing. What thing would you help?
Which story are you going to wrap up? The other two are going to remain unresolved.
And he picks the one that he can control, which actually is someone who deserves a break.
Yeah.
It's a good ending to that movie. Here, it doesn't really have even that sense of purpose.
Mm.
It has something to say, but it doesn't actually have much to say about it, unfortunately, which I find very frustrating. I feel like if that had been the whole focus of the movie, you could have had a movie, but it wasn't your focus.
There's a kind of filmmaking that comes from typically very widely respected directors where they're doing genre exercises. I feel this way about, Quentin Tarantino does this.
Death Proof in particular is a good example.
Paul Thomas Anderson kind of does that as well.
Not a few times.
Yeah. Guillermo del Toro does it for sure. Mm-hmm. The idea of these filmmakers, Edgar Wright does it.
Oh, yeah.
The idea of they're very stylish filmmakers with their own voice, but they've sort of settled into a certain kind of career path.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're only going to recreate a specific genre they're fond of using their style.
Yeah, Ed Wright's a great example because I think his early films, his first four films, are definitely him bringing some real like ingenuity and thought and purpose behind he's Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz.
Clearly inspired by Sam Raimi, but bringing his own flavor to it.
But his more recent films, which I like to, well, I like one of them, Baby Driver, is, hey, what if I did Walter Hill's Driver?
Yeah.
Basically, that's the movie. And then Last Night in Soho. Is it Last Night in Soho?
Last Night in Soho.
That was him like, hey, what if I did kind of like a 70s thriller?
A 60s JD thriller.
Yeah.
Fallen woman narrative.
Yeah. Slash Giallo. And that one does not work. Yeah. It's some great cinematography, but my God, does that story
And I feel
not
like Ty West has fallen down that... And here's the thing. I know a lot of people who greatly admire that kind of genre exercise. Like, we're going to...
They can be great.
We're going to, like, be a little bit more self-aware about a genre and modernize it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people really... Like, when Guillermo del Toro says, hey, I'm going to make a Hammer movie. It's going to be called Crimson Peak. It's you have something to say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to simply repeat somebody else's voice.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear what you have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when a filmmaker starts going down that path, it's... However thrilling the experiments are, there is a twinge of disappointment to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like we're missing out on what kind of genre they could invent. Who's going to imitate them?
Yeah.
And I feel like Ty West definitely did that. He did it with X because he's doing like 70s slasher movies. And porn and that kind of style.
Yeah, it's kind of its own thing. Yeah.
Pearl feels more unique.
Yeah.
It has a lot... It's
a story that demanded to be told.
It looks different. The character is unique. Yeah. Mia Goth gives a great performance. And, you know, you could say it's a riff on Psycho, but it's not.
No, it's
not. He's clearly creating something new. Pearl is an interesting character.
Yeah, and a distinct character, yeah.
Maxine Minx, also an interesting character.
Love Maxine Minx as a character.
But she's lost in this salad of pastiche.
Yeah.
Where we're just sort of repeating a lot of 1980s sleaze fests.
Mm-hmm.
To no real end other than to say, hey, look what I'm doing.
And that can work. I would argue that maybe in a slightly different degree, that's all Kill Bill is. It's basically Quentin Tarantino. Here's a bunch of shit I like. And guess what? I like it too, dude.
Mm.
And you do it good, and it's cool, and it's fun to watch, and occasionally it's powerful, and it's great. I know you can't talk about it.
The difference is, Kill Bill is 21 years old at this point.
I understand that. I'm just saying, but here's what I'm comparing it to. I'm not comparing it to just a filmmaker likes something and wants to do it. What I think Kill Bill does, and what I think at its best, what Maxine does, is there were a lot of people who saw Kill Bill who had never seen Lady Snowblood.
Yeah.
Who had never seen, like, Executioners from Shaolin or, like, any of the other, like, 70s grindhousey type movies that had inspired Quentin Tarantino to make this film.
Yeah.
And because he, and to his credit, is never afraid to call his shots. He will say, here's what I'm ripping off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bringing it my own, but here's what I'm ripping off. It becomes kind of like a history class for a new generation of film goers or film lovers that we can use this film as your gateway to this part of cinema.
It's like a little bit of a skeleton key.
Yeah, and I would argue that although Maxine doesn't quite work as a film, I think Mia Goth's performance keeps it held together pretty strong, but it doesn't really work as a whole film. I think its functionality is introducing a younger generation of filmmakers to this oft overlooked section of 1980s horror slash crime movies that aren't generally respected very much.
That's true. But had some of them do stank. But
some of them do stank, and some of them are still popular. But none of them are like hugely popular. None of them have a huge audience to this day.
It's hard to say though, because you know I log into Shudder and you can see Vice Squad just up on the front there.
But even Shudder doesn't have the same numbers that Netflix does. That's still kind of a niche. I'm talking about this movie. These movies are pretty popular. Yeah, they're not blockbusters.
I would encourage people to watch. Strip to Kill, I think, is a good movie.
Yeah.
Vice Squad is a terrible movie, but it's very entertaining.
It's worth seeing, but it is sleazy.
Yeah.
Angel is a good movie.
Yeah. Avenging Angel is a bad movie.
I have not seen Avenging
Angel. Someone with this, fighting bad guys with fistfuls of glitter. It's pretty ridiculous.
Sounds awesome.
Maybe that was Angel 3.
There are quite a few Angel movies, actually.
There's Avenging Angel. There's Angel 3.
And is that it?
There was an Angel 4, but I think it's a separate thing. It's a new character.
It's basically, we did a new movie, but it was enough like Angel, we could put Angel on it.
Yeah.
Because that was enough of a hit to be a franchise.
In the Grindhouse world.
Almost straight to video kind of realm. But
look up the Angel movies because... Yeah.
But if this movie does nothing but introduce audiences to and bring a certain air of respectability to a subgenre that previously was a little obscure and had no respectability, kudos.
Let's see.
I will say that that is at least a positive function.
Yeah, Angel was 84. Avenging Angel was 85, and then Angel 3, The Final Chapter,
Final Chapter.
1988.
Yay.
And I think there was an Angel 4.
I feel like there was.
Angel 4, Undercover.
Ah.
Directed by Richard Shankman.
Okay.
Which nobody knows about.
No, that's completely forgotten by history, but maybe we should check it out. Anyway, I think we've wrapped this up. It is time to review movies on our critically acclaimed scale. Just so we're clear about where we stand. The critically acclaimed scale runs from C- to C+. The lowest a movie can get is a C-. That's a movie we don't recommend. Either because we just don't think it's very good or we think it sucks. A C is an average movie. That's a movie that's, does what it sets out to do, but not just okay. Mixed bag. Meh. And then a C+ is the highest rating a movie can get. That's an above average movie. That's a movie that we genuinely recommend for one reason or another, to one degree or another. On that note, Whitney, Maxine,
it's a C. It's not a complete wash, but it's a mess. Kicking the table. I love Mia Goth. She's great. Kevin Bacon gives a great performance. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in little chunks throughout this movie. It's a bunch of really cool scenes.
Yeah.
Just sort of tossed together in a really haphazard way.
I think it's a fair assessment.
I don't like that it is little more than a genre exercise, but yeah, to your point, not everybody's going to necessarily know about Vice Squad.
Yeah.
So listen to us. See Vice Squad.
Yeah.
See Angel. See Strip to Kill. These are good movies.
Vice Squad in particular probably needs to come with a lot of content warnings. Angel some too, but
These are sleazy movies from the 1980s that are very frank about their sexual attitudes.
If you like Maxine, which is extremely violent and intense, you'll be fine. If you're watching them because you like Maxine, they're not going to... You're not going to be shocked.
Yeah,
you're just going to be like, oh, it's more of the same. But yeah, I think it's as close to a C+ as you can get without being a C for me. All
right.
I really do think Mia Goth anchors it really well. I like some of the supporting performances a lot. I think it does a great job of creating the world of the slightly heightened 1980s Sunset Boulevard. But it is a sloppy kiss of a movie. Mm. This doesn't quite come together. Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F.
Also a C.
Yeah.
Inoffensive, right up the middle, kind of bland, diverting, not offensive entertainment.
Yeah, it's kind of a textbook C for me, where it does what it says on the tin. Axel Foley is in it, and he's engaged. He's in the movie. He's not like doesn't look like he's here for the paycheck. But it doesn't do anything terribly interesting. It's not particularly exciting. It's not particularly funny. But mm-hmm. it's certainly amiable, and if you like the original movies, you'll probably enjoy the trip down memory lane. Yeah. So yeah, it's a put its picture next to a C in a dictionary. and then lastly, Despicable Me 4.
Also right up the middle, man. Oh, man. This is just a nice old bland fest this time around. Maxine is not bland, it's just not successful.
Yeah, but it's trying to do something interesting. But
Despicable Me 4, Beverly Hills Cop 4, those are predictable Hollywood products, especially Despicable Me 4. So yeah, it's a C.
Yeah.
I'm not angry at it
because
I understand I was just going to see a big Hollywood product.
They never pretended to be anything else.
No, if you like fast food burgers, there it is for you.
All right, well, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. We'll be back next time with reviews of the new serial killer film Long Legs, directed by Osgood Perkins.
Mm-hmm.
Fly Me to the Moon, a romantic comedy set at NASA, I think 1950s or 60s, starring Channing Tatum and Scarlett Johansson. Really
fake the moon landing. That's the plot of that one.
Is that really the plot of that one?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's been
part of the same radio that NASA used when they faked the Apollo moon landings.
Okay, all right, fair enough. And other things as well. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. Huge shout out to all of our patrons. You are great people. Just you're awesome. You're wonderful. You're smart. You're funny. Everyone likes you.
And let us know what you think of Vice Squad. If you actually bother to track it down, give us a review of Vice Squad.
I would love that. Our email address, if you want to join our Patreon, it's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows over there. Whole series of shows, hundreds of shows are available to you if you sign up. And you also get our new episodes ad-free. If you want to talk to us about anything we discussed in this episode, I'd be curious if anyone has any thoughts about my theory about Axel Foley. If you want to tell us that you saw Vice Squad or any of the other movies recommended from Maxine and you want to give us your thoughts, we'd love to hear those too. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Send us an actual physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep, we're on social media. We're at Critic Acclaim. I am at William DeBiani.
At Whitney Seibel.
And never forget, everyone is a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?
This season, Instacart has your back to school. As in, they've got your back to school lunch favorites like snack packs and fresh fruit. And they've got your back to school supplies like backpacks, binders, and pencils. And they've got your back when your kid casually tells you they have a huge school project due tomorrow. Let's face it, we were all that kid. So first call your parents to say, I'm sorry. And then download the Instacart app to get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes all school year long. Get a $0 delivery fee for your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.